Good morning, everybody, and happy Friday to you. My name is Connor Collins. I'm a registered massage therapist and sports injury therapist. Welcome to the Concast, a podcast where we discuss all things health, wellness, and injuries in an attempt to better understand the human body. This is episode 100, where I had the pleasure of interviewing Jennifer Stacey. Jennifer is a registered massage therapist practicing in Chilliwack, British Columbia, in Canada, and has a special interest in Ehlers-Danlos syndrome and hypermobility disorders. Throughout this podcast, we discussed updated diagnostic criteria for people with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, what you might be able to do if you have a suspected hypermobility disorder yourself, as well as if you're a clinician, some of the things that you may want to consider in either your treatment, management, or exercise prescription for this subset of the population. It was a really great conversation. As always, I learned a lot. So sit back, enjoy the interview. Good morning, everybody. Happy Friday to you. Welcome back to another interview. And this morning, we're going to be talking about something that I don't think a lot of people are talking about. So I'm looking forward to today's conversation with Jennifer around kind of a topic that, like I said, not a lot of people are overly familiar with. And that is the topic of hypermobility and how, you know, Jennifer and I were talking off the podcast about how I kind of got notice of her was she posted something on social media regarding, I think it was an iceberg. You can correct me if I'm wrong in a moment, but I think it was an iceberg, and it was basically the tip of the iceberg being these disorders, if that's the proper characterization of them, of hypermobility, and then all of the other things that could potentially go along with that. So I'm looking forward to learning a little bit more myself this morning about hypermobility disorders. It's not something that I'm overly familiar with in my practice, but Jennifer, welcome to the podcast, and I look forward to this morning's conversation.
Hi, thank you for having me, Connor. I really appreciate it.
No problem. So before we get into this topic of hypermobility, why don't we learn a little bit more about you and your practice and kind of how, whereabouts you're located and how you came about getting into this as an area of special interest?
Yeah, so I am an RMT in Chilliwack, BC. I graduated as an RMT in about 2018, but with board exam scheduling, I couldn't complete my board exams until the November following. So I've been registered for just 3 years now. I have a small practice out of my home clinic. I was in a bigger clinic for 2 years, but after we got shut down from COVID, we slowly opened back up summer of 2020. And with all the new regulations and things we had to do, I decided just to go home full time. My anxiety was really high trying to navigate the new normal alongside 50 plus employees. So it just made sense for me to have a space where I was fully in control of those operations. But I was just going to take a leave of absence for 2 months and work from home and quickly realized that just having more control was better. So it's worked out and I haven't looked back. So how I got into massage therapy is I've always had a desire to help people, and it's been really apparent in my career paths. I was a hairdresser, a teacher, a youth coordinator. I worked as support staff for people with disabilities and then eventually led into being an RMT. In 2012, my daughter was born and she had some health issues. And to address those health issues, we did a clean sweep of chemicals from our home and went as natural as possible. And I got into an essential oil business and was really drawn to the aromatherapy and treatment side of the business. And I was taking training in that, and I was treating clients at home. And I really loved that side of the business. And then through years of personal development, growth, and goal planning, I discovered that I wanted to have a healing center, a wellness center, where I could help treat people and watch this healing take place. So I was led into massage therapy to reach this goal. And then in 2016, I left my teaching career to pursue a career as an RMT. And on that first day of class, I knew I had finally found my purpose. I am so passionate about massage therapy, and I really look forward to growing as a massage therapist in the years to come.
Yeah, it sounds like quite the journey you've been through, and obviously you're still relatively new in your career, but now you've found this sort of niche market within the field of, I think, chronic pain and hypermobility. So it sounds like the transition of the last 2 years, while maybe a little bit difficult, has been somewhat of a blessing in disguise for you, where you've been able to kind of morph your practice and gain a new special interest in some of these topics. Would that be accurate? Because I know people have dealt with this in different ways. Some people have had a really difficult time with it. Other people have had I think everybody in some way, shape, or form has had a difficult time with it. Some people have chosen to leave the career massage therapy. Some people have chosen to morph theirs a little bit. Sounds like you've done that and it's turned out very well for you.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been great. I love working from home. I've been thinking about opening a clinic, like mulling this around in my head. It's like, I see so many people need therapists. We really have such a shortage out here on the West Coast. And I was like, I need to make a clinic and have all these therapists come to me. But really, I think I need to educate therapists on the things that I'm seeing, because I'm not going to make more therapists.
Yeah, I was just having a conversation with Whitney Lowe a couple of podcasts ago, and we were talking about, you know, Whitney's been in the field for, I think, over 3 decades now, and he left his clinical practice to pursue teaching full time. And I was asking him if he missed it or not, and he said he definitely missed clinical practice. But one of the things he has discovered is kind of just alluding to what you said, is that he feels as though he can help the field of massage therapy more by teaching therapists and then have them go out and spread kind of just philosophies in general about treatment and that sort of thing. So I can definitely relate to that. I also tell students myself that home practice is where it's at, because you've got so much flexibility. Not that I have a home practice myself, but you've got so much flexibility, autonomy. And there's definitely some benefits to running a clinic, but running clinics is very busy and very time consuming. So it sounds like you're set up pretty well there. So why hypermobility then? What got you into this exploration of hypermobility in general?
So actually, just from personal experience with my own hypermobility, I always knew that I was flexible, but I had no idea that there was these implications as well, like that iceberg you were talking about. My mom and I would always compare our double jointedness and do the party tricks and laugh and joke and everything. And in my adult years, I would dominate at flexibility games. We used to play this game where you would take a bag and you'd rip off a section. And then eventually you would just have to pick up the bottom section of a bag off the floor without using your hands. And I always won this game. Everyone always joked. They're like, gosh, you're so flexible. And then in RMT school, we did the bite and scale. And of course, I am hypermobile in every joint on that scale, and was told that I would just have to be extra careful as an RMT for the wear and tear on my joints, but really nothing past that. And then this past spring, 2021, a chiropractor actually mentioned to me that I might have this genetic condition called EDS. I denied it. I was like, no, that's impossible. Not that I knew anything about it at all, but I assumed I was a healthy individual. I didn't think I was really sick. I had these weird symptoms randomly. They didn't happen all the time. And it wasn't until I started researching for myself that I realized, oh my goodness, I think I have this. And then I went in and got diagnosed myself from an internal specialist. And now she's referring me off. And all the areas where I do experience symptoms, I'm now going to different specialists to have them assessed and looked at. And I'm on a year-long wait list for a geneticist. I'm on a wait list for an echocardiogram. And I have a couple new doctor's appointments coming up in the near future as well. So where it goes from here, we will see.
So Ehlers-Danlos syndrome is the syndrome, I guess. And from what I understand, there are many subsets of this syndrome and only some of them are related to hypermobility. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's 13 subsets of Ehlers-Danlos, and I don't know all 13 of them off my head. I only really look at the hypermobility, and I know a little bit about the vascular as well, because that one is the one they want to rule out first. But of the 13, 12 of them have genetic components. So you go see the geneticist, they do the test, and they can say whether you have the gene for any of the other 12. But hypermobility is the only one that doesn't have a gene yet. In 2017, hypermobility spectrum disorder and HEDS were kind of under the same umbrella, but then they've separated that now as different diagnoses so that they can narrow down the genetic implications. So they're really trying to isolate the genes that are involved. And I've been listening to podcasts and the experts speaking on this, and there's one clinic out of the States that thinks they might have isolated a gene, but they're predicting that it's going to actually be multiple genes. And they said that it could be possibly hypermobile EDS might even be split further once they start isolating these genes.
And so what they're trying to do now is even parse out hypermobility related to EDS versus non-EDS hypermobility. Is that, did I understand what you said there, right? Trying to split off those two disorders to find some potential genetic link?
Yeah, so some people in 2017, when they reorganized the diagnostic criteria, actually lost their diagnostic EDS and got put into the hypermobility. But from what I understand, hypermobility comes after they've ruled out EDS. So if they do all the testing and everything and rule it out via clinical exam, then you would have the hypermobility spectrum disorder after that.
And this is because, and clarify this if I'm incorrect, is that EDS has potentially a number of other comorbid clinical presentations with it, depending upon what type of EDS you might have, versus a hypermobility spectrum disorder that is non-EDS wouldn't necessarily have as many comorbid clinical conditions. Would that be correct?
From what I understand, they both can have the comorbid conditions. So okay. The hypermobility spectrum disorder and the HEDS.
Okay. Is one characterized as, I'll use the word worse, does one have more comorbid conditions or not really?
No, not really. They're vast and they both can have the same ones from what I understand.
Okay. So with respect to I know that you mentioned their vascular EDS being the one that they really want to rule out. Why might that be? Is that because that's the more sort of severe version of EDS?
Yeah, that one can be life-threatening. So vascular EDS, some of the people have a lower life expectancy. So they can die from a mitral valve prolapse in the heart or a bowel rupture. So when we see people having bowel ruptures or family history of bowel ruptures, it's something to make note of. Those can be life-threatening. So they really want to rule that out first. And that's why they're sending me for all these heart tests. As soon as they were like, you have a diagnosis, we're sending you, I've already done the stress test, the Holter test. And then I had something else, another monitor put on. And they said, my heart is great. Like there's nothing wrong with that. But when I did the Holter test, they were getting feedback for when I was having the heart rate influxes, it has to do with POTS. So I was diagnosed with POTS as well on top of my HEDS.
For the listeners, can you talk a little bit about POTS? What is POTS and what might be some of the symptoms you experience or even people experience with POTS?
So POTS is short for postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. So when you change positions, your heart rate goes up really fast and your blood can pool in your limbs so you can get dizzy. And when I was a kid, if I was to get up off the couch and walk, the room would spin, I would black out, and I would wake up in a pool on the floor, having no recollection of what happened. And I don't actually faint now, but I still am really affected by change of temperature, change of position. I love hiking. If there's too much elevation quickly, I get super nauseous, dizzy. I can't continue. We have to hike very slow. It increases anxiety. Like, there's a whole bunch of things that go along with POTS as well. And I'm learning more every day. Things that you don't even realize are involved can be involved. It has to do with the autonomic nervous system. So when that's dysfunctioning, they call it dysautonomia. POTS is one example of dysautonomia. There's orthostatic intolerances other than POTS as well. Other things that I experience is heavy sweating, like for no reason. I'll just start sweating. I'll be freezing cold and sweating, dizzy, anxiety. I'll get nauseous, just nausea will just trigger for no reason. If I'm stressed out, the symptoms get worse. If I'm not prepared for something, my brain will like shut down and I can't, like, it's all in there. I can't find it. And then I was actually just reading an article the other day saying the reason that happens is because it's constricting blood flow to the brain. So I had a scan years ago and they were watching the blood flow in my brain. They said that there was a restriction. So they sent me to Nuka Chiropractic and I had some treatments done with them and I had wonderful results. And the reason that I was going to them is because I was having recurrent migraines as much as every, I think it was 11 days on average when I was tracking it. And that made me really nervous because it was new. I always had migraines, but not that recurrent. But I was finding that was when I was teaching and I wasn't sure if it was the lights or if it was the smells in the rooms or the smells of cologne, because I'm really sensitive to that stuff as well. And then that's another comorbid condition that could also be piled onto this one. So it can be really complicated, really muddied, and they can all have the same symptoms. So it's really difficult sometimes and sometimes can take up to 10 years to get a full or proper diagnosis while having these conditions.
Well, and as you alluded to, this is something from a POTS standpoint that you'd been struggling with since you were a young child, and you didn't find out maybe the nature of that until well into your adult years. And meanwhile, maybe you're going for a number of different clinical exams or tests throughout the course of your lifetime, and people are sort of saying that they can't find anything, right? And that's, as you know, has so many other potential confounding psychosocial factors in terms of, you know, is it all in my head? Am I struggling? And I'm not suggesting that all anxiety is POTS or vice versa, but there's certainly something to be said there for the potential stressors that that would create. And then if you do in fact have this, then that's only going to make your symptoms worse. So you mentioned POTS. What are some other common clinical presentations? And I know that you alluded to some of them there just previously. Are there any others that you see common in your clinical practice or experience yourself that people with EDS also have with respect to their hypermobility?
Yeah, absolutely. So another thing I experience is Raynaud's phenomenon. So I am very sensitive to cold. My fingers turn bright blue when they're cold. It's not even when my fingers are cold. If my core is cold, then my fingers go blue. I do not like being cold and I do not like being hot. So it's a really fun place to try to be in the middle, to try to find that medium ground of warm, cold. Other things are mast cell activation. So this is another part of it that I'm trying to get checked out. Our body's full of mast cells. They're the first line of defense when it comes to immunity. And when mast cells are overactive, they are being triggered by non-noxious stimuli. And that can include temperature change. So the temperature of the room can change and it can throw a person into full body hives. It can present like asthma. So if they're triggered by something, you can think you're having an asthma attack. And when I was in junior high, a doctor, for no reason, like I had gone in because I was having trouble breathing. I had spiked a volleyball and lost my breath. And I had gone to the hospital. He told me I had asthma and started putting me on inhalers. The inhaler, it was weird. You turned it and crushed it. And it was this long white thing. And you inhaled the powder from crushing whatever was in there. And this thing made me retch. And I was taking this thing four times a day. And it was horrific. Eventually, I just stopped taking it. I never needed it again. Like, I didn't have asthma. I believe I was misdiagnosed. I was going in a couple days a week. I had to leave school and walk up and have, I don't know what was in it, but like a respirator mask, and I had to breathe in whatever they were pumping through it. So that was completely unnecessary treatments. Maybe it wasn't unnecessary. I actually don't know. But looking back, like, that maybe could have been avoided had there been more knowledge around mast cell activation as well.
And there are a lot of people that have these interesting, whether it's environmental allergen reactions or that's what they're diagnosed as. And I think the important thing that I should stress here as we continue this conversation is that we're not saying everything is EDS.
Absolutely.
And I think everyone needs to understand that, but we're just having a conversation around, yeah, there are people that have these interesting reactions to things. Sometimes it's really hard in medicine, where whether it be biomedical medicine or paramedicine, things like chiropractic physical therapy, a lot of the time we are looking for answers and we are looking for fixes. But I think one of the things that sometimes we have to be okay with, and while it's really important to sometimes get that accurate diagnosis of, let's say, in the case of someone that has EDS but doesn't have a diagnosis, sometimes there isn't a diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
It's like people are going to have to try and manage whatever that is. And I know that a lot of your practice is chronic and persistent pain. And sometimes people that are looking for the answer of, I want to be pain-free, mm-hmm. sometimes that's not a realistic expectation for the individual anymore. And reframing that and allowing them to have a conversation with you about, okay, what are some reasonable expectations for you, might in fact help them a little bit more than saying, I'm going to be able to help you. No one else has helped you, and I'm going to be the one that's going to get you to be pain-free. Puts an awful lot of pressure on the person receiving the therapeutic intervention. It also puts a lot of pressure on the therapist to then try and deliver that promise.
Absolutely.
It is a really, in speaking with you off the podcast, this reminds me of lupus in a way, in many ways, where lupus is, you know, called the great mimicker, and it often has these very ambiguous symptoms. And while there's a common sharing of symptoms among many people that suffer from lupus, each individual goes through their own little experience. And so it sounds like there's a lot to try and tease out in terms of comorbid conditions and then linking them back to EDS.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the hypermobility piece, do you know why people with EDS are hypermobile? Like, what is it from a genetic standpoint? Is it related to their connective tissue, or what are some of the things that make individuals more hypermobile in these certain subtypes of EDS?
Yeah, absolutely. So hypermobility EDS is a connective tissue disorder. So when we're looking in the scope of all this stuff, I think it might be good to maybe break down a couple of the definitions. So joint hypermobility is the term used to describe the capacity for a joint to move past its normal limits. So it can exist by itself or part of a more complex diagnosis, and not everyone who has hypermobility has a disorder. So some people are just flexible. It's when you bring it in with other components, that's what would make it a disorder. So if there's fewer than five joints, it's localized joint hypermobility. And if there's five plus joints, it's generalized joint hypermobility. So often sometimes you're born with it, possibly inherited, and there are acquired forms of hypermobility as well. So like people that are training for dance, people with widespread inflammatory or degenerative diseases of the joints, there's musculoskeletal tissues and nerves, hypothyroidism, and other endocrine disorders. So those can make acquired joint hypermobility. Hypermobility spectrum disorder is a group of conditions related to joint hypermobility and is intended to be diagnosed after other possible things are ruled out, like I mentioned before. And it can have significant effects on health. And it's important that they're managed appropriately and everybody is treated as an individual. HSD and HEDS can equal in severity, but More importantly, they both need similar management, validation, and care. Along with the joint hypermobility spectrum disorder. So you have the flexible joints, and then the secondary musculoskeletal manifestations are there. And you need one or more of these in order for it to be a disorder on top of the joint hypermobility. So this would include things like macro traumas. So that would be dislocations, subluxations, or soft tissue damage. Can cause acute pain and loss of joint function from the macro traumas. And then another one would be micro traumas. So these are injuries that are really small. You don't even realize they're happening. And over time, it can make you more susceptible to recurrent or persistent pain. Another MSK manifestation is chronic pain, perhaps because of the unusual sensitivity to pain or the impaired connective tissue function can make the chronic pain worse. And then another manifestation would be disturbed proprioception. So really not knowing your place in space and time, being clumsy. And then other MSK traits would include like flat feet, misaligned toes and misaligned bones in the elbows, mild to moderate scoliosis, hyperkyphosis of the upper spine, and then lordosis of the lower spine. And then there's problems associated that might not be musculoskeletal. These issues are not related to the mechanics of the joint, but need to be managed as part of the treatment. And they can include anxiety disorders, the orthostatic intolerances, a variety of functional GI disorders, pelvic and bladder problems. So if you suspect hypermobility, it is really important to look at those things as well.
Yeah, that was really, really thorough, Jen. If I hear you correctly, it starts with hypermobility because that is sort of, from our standpoint, maybe the more obvious thing that we can start to parse out.
Yes.
And then we go through diagnostic criteria. It sounds like it could be as simple as a questionnaire. I'm assuming that's what it is essentially. And then we parse that out. I guess the more ticks in the boxes, the more we lean back towards that referral. Going back to the very first thing that you said, I believe you said something about global versus local hypermobility and the relation of joints in the body. And you said five joints is localized hypermobility.
Under five would be local. Okay. Five and over is general.
Okay. And these are, I'm assuming, the large, more obvious joints of the body, wrist, elbow, shoulder.
Hips, yeah.
Hips, ankle.
Spine.
And that type of thing.
Yeah.
And I know, like you alluded to, which was a very important point, it's like hypermobility, again, is relative to the individual. And it's really hard for us to say across an entire population, what does that really mean, right? Because we don't have a really great working definition of like, it's 5 degrees beyond 180 for the shoulder, for example. And I know that we use this Batten score a lot of the time in our clinical practice. Now would be a good time to just maybe briefly outline the Batten score. Should we do that a little bit later? Because I know it's something that we use pretty frequently, and maybe just what that might entail.
Yeah, so the Batten score has actually been debated whether it's the best one, but it is the one that is used. So it limits it to 9 joints. You have the finger, bending your pinky finger back 90 degrees or more. So you'd get 1 point for each hand. Your thumb to wrist. So if you can touch your thumb to your wrist, you get 1 point for each hand. Your elbows, if they go past 10 degrees, when you straighten your arms, that's 1 point for each elbow. Your knees, if your knee hyperextends backwards, you get 1 point per knee. And if you can bend over and touch the ground with your hands, you get 1 point for your spine. So it's a total of 9. That's the Batten score.
I've just watched Jennifer master Batten score for the first time ever on the podcast for those people that can't see this interview because we're doing the audio only. These aren't points that you necessarily want to get for the fact that the more points you get, the more hypermobile you are. All cases, hypermobility isn't a bad thing, but I think that maybe using the Batten score with what you alluded to regarding global joint hypermobility might offer more utility as well, right? Like if The Bighton score, as you said, isolates it to fingers, thumbs, elbows, knees, and then bending forward. But then if the person is also mentioning, look, my ankles, my hips are also really, really hypermobile, I can do a back bridge and all of these other things, then you're like, okay, well, you're really, really mobile here. Mm-hmm. And then you go into these other subsets of the diagnostic criteria, particularly some of the things that you mentioned regarding macro trauma and, you know, people breaking a lot of bones, people dislocating a lot of joints. You use the word subluxation, which for people that aren't familiar with what that word means, it essentially means the joint comes out and then reduces or goes back in on its own or partially comes out, whereas a dislocation, all of the joint surfaces separate. And generally speaking, depending upon the environment that you're in, you need some sort of medical procedure to put it back in. And then going down the line, do you have issues with blood flow? Do you have issues with GI disorders? And really looking at, as you mentioned, that whole person's experience and seeing where it might lay. But I think the really thing that I like the most about how you framed that, which I haven't really thought about for myself, is you start with the hypermobility and then you work backwards. And the reason that I like that is because over the years, when I talk to different professionals in all fields, when we're talking about the importance of a health intake or a health interview, we often talk about analyzing all the systems of the body, right? We might ask about, you know, do you have any issues with bowel or bladder function, for example, in the context of low back pain? Do you have any digestive upset? But how often do I think to myself, do I use the Bighton score as much as I should to assess hypermobility and then make that link back to potentially something like an EDS? I would admittedly not do that very well. I do use it quite a bit because I think it is, the reason that I use it is because I think it's, you know, a great clinical utility. It takes 3 minutes to run out a Bighton score, right? Can you do this, 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 this? It's very quick. It gives you a quick global picture. But then linking it back through the health history, I think is something that you've really raised a really good connection point there for I think a lot of therapists.
Yeah. And also they use this, it's can you now or could you ever? So it's not even can you right now do the Bighton score? I can still like pretzel. So I haven't lost any flexibility that way. But for people with chronic pain where their body's starting to not seize up, but starting to be more restricted, they can't do that.
Right. And they're adapting for a variety of reasons. Yeah. That's a really good point as well. So yeah. What was that line you used? Can you now or could you ever?
Yes.
I like that a lot.
They have like the EDS Society has a page that you can print off and it's the diagnostic criteria. And although we cannot diagnose as RMTs, I've gone through this with clients and I've done the Bighton scale and then I'll go through the other criteria and I don't know everything that's on there. So there's some stuff I'm like, I don't know what that is. You'll have to talk to your doctor. So I'll actually go through the diagnostic criteria and take it and I'll make notes on the back why I think it's important for them to be assessed further. So it helps with that referral because if they can see like, oh, all these things are there. Another part of a problem is memory, not remembering everything that's related. And you go to the doctor's appointment and you can't recall it all. So having these notes on one page and then writing stuff on the back of the page for your client can go a long way for treatment, not just by us, but those like, what did Jocelyn call it? That meaningful referral. And that can really help with that.
Yeah, for sure. That's one of my, you know, as I mentioned to you before, one of my favorite lines of the year, meaningful referral is, you know, sometimes, as you said, and when you're the one that's seeing these individuals on a regular basis, and the thing that I like about the meaningful referral with evidence-informed information is it is a really meaningful referral. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like you've kind of said, I don't really know, can you look at this? You've sent validated information and you've said, look, this person has global hypermobility. They're hypermobile in 5+ joints. They score 8 out of 9 on the Beighton scale. I've gone through these other diagnostic criteria and they've checked, you know, 95% of this. They don't have really a working diagnosis. Might this be something that's worth investigating? Now, if I get that as the family doctor, there wouldn't be a reason for you to pursue that further other than your ego, right? Like if all of the information is in front of you and you've got the person that you're taking care of's best interest in mind, you would be doing yourself a service and themselves a service to warrant that referral versus if the referral is, I don't know what's going on. And this doesn't mean that all of the time we have to have the answers, but it's just like if people come into our office and they say, I just don't know. It's a very, very broad world out there for us to then try and peel that back and come to some sort of conclusion about the myriad of things that we might think as to what's going on, which is always why I find it a little bit humorous that people claim to have the exact fix and the exact diagnosis for the number of people that we see, because as you know, no ankle sprain's the same. It's really hard to even try and, you know, pinpoint that a lot of the time. And you've said it a number of times, look, I don't have all the answers here and neither do I, but it's about providing information in a way that is offering both the person and the practitioner great clinical utility to give them an idea, because we're all in practice together, right? So it sounds like if somebody's listening to this podcast and they've maybe related to some of the things that, you know, they've been listening to, they're really mobile and they've got maybe some of these symptoms, that the EDS Society is a great resource to maybe start if they can't, you know, necessarily communicate that with their overseeing practitioner and then work backwards from there.
Absolutely. So that's been my main source for information, especially starting out. Google was not very helpful, but then I was directed to the EDS Society website, probably from Google. And that's how I found them. And they have research on there. They have teaching opportunities. So they host classes all year to teach. Like I went through one of their ECHO programs as a clinician. They have clinicians from all over the world talking about this stuff. They have presenters on each topic. Like, it's amazing. I'm in one right now, like how to start a support group. And it's people within this society that have gathered people from all over the world that want to start these support groups. And there's way more than just those two. I think it's February 19th. We're doing an allergy and immunology summit. So I've signed up for this to learn the new research coming out from Dr. Anne Maitland is speaking. She's huge in the immunology field and works with the mast cell population. And she was one of the presenters in the ECHO course. And I am so looking forward to just diving into all this new research and information that's coming out of that too.
Well, and it's just such a great time that we're living in from a technology perspective to be able to connect with these, you know, great professionals that are trying to work and make inroads into some of these, you know, more, I don't know if you want to call them obscure, but maybe difficult to diagnose disorders, along with all the other topics within our field. I mean, again, I'll reference Whitney again in this episode, but we were having a conversation around when he first started to gather information, he would have to go into the stacks of the library, pull a journal. If it wasn't there, he'd have to go back a few days later, photocopy it. I mean, we can get 30 journals in 10 minutes right now on Google Scholar, you know, and just download them, and we can have access to all these great webinars and speakers. And even this, having conversation on via podcast, is technology has been amazing for that. So allowing people to, and as you mentioned, the support group thing, just allowing people to be a little bit more familiar if this is something that they have about potentially some of the comorbid stuff, as well as to maybe manage it. Let's go a little bit down kind of the treatment rabbit hole. We'll talk about it from maybe a paramedical standpoint. And then if there is anything biomedical you want to add, then feel free. When you're seeing individuals in your practice now, we obviously can't treat a genetically influenced hypermobility disorder. We also can't treat some of these comorbid things that an individual presents with when they have EDS. How are you structuring your treatments? What is your primary goal, or what do you see people benefiting from in a massage therapy room when you're treating individuals that are coming in with EDS or hypermobility spectrum disorders?
The main thing they're coming in for is chronic pain. So treating chronic pain, understanding chronic pain is huge. I had a client just the other day during treatment, shoulder subluxes. Like, I wasn't working on his arm or anything like that. So he said it doesn't hurt. He's able to just put it right back in. So just being aware of what supports are needed during that session as well. If knees need to be supported because they'll sublux, shoulders need to be supported because they'll fall out of joint. If there's cervical cranial instability, so if the C1, C2 is unstable, like, should we be treating that C1, C2 area, or will that cause more problems? So really getting to know what the client's issues are, that's how I structure my treatment. It's very individual based. There's no two people I treat the same. And that goes for all my clients. It's not just the EDS population. Another thing to be aware of is the temperature changes. Like, I do not like a heated table cover. That just, it throws me into sweating. My autonomic system goes crazy. I have a electric table. So the head raises. If the head raises too fast, sometimes it can throw dizziness. It can throw another pot spell. So just being aware of that. Clinical representations. Yeah, you need to be aware of triggers. So smells in the room could really trigger. Perfume. If someone wears perfume to a treatment, I get migraines, nausea. And I haven't had to ask anyone to not come yet, but there's sometimes I'm like, oh no, I forgot to tell them, and they'll come in and I'll work through it. But yeah, making sure you're not wearing colognes, like, that can be disastrous. That's one of the reasons I suffered so much teaching, was because I taught middle school and they wore that Axe spray. The grade 8 hallway was like toxic.
Yeah. Good old Axe body spray. A smell you'll never forget, right?
Almost took me to my knees multiple times.
So I think just going that extra mile in terms of the things that we already do, but being very mindful of the potential Absolutely. Triggers for individuals. I would imagine, and again, nothing is true for everyone, but being very mindful of just like end range of motion stuff, aggressive mm-hmm. stretching stuff, particularly if there is a hypermobility condition, there might be something to consider as well, but there may also be people that are okay with that. In terms of non-treatment management and care with respect to maybe movement and strength and lifestyle management, do you provide that to individuals? What are you seeing for the individuals that are suffering from chronic pain that they are finding to be beneficial? I mean, I know that one of the things that we know helps people with persistent or chronic pain is movement and exercise. And I don't know if that's, if there's a subset of, because I know one of the, I saw a study that was posted in some of the evidence-based groups regarding activity and chronic fatigue syndrome and how it mm-hmm. actually isn't being suggested for chronic fatigue syndrome as much anymore, because generally speaking, exercise is like the default for everything, right? Exercise and lifestyle. And that can mean a whole host of things depending upon the person. But this was one of the first studies that I've seen come out where it's like, no, don't encourage exercise and activity for this subset of the population. How are things kind of communicated for the EDS population regarding that?
So EDS population, hypermobility, absolutely. You want small structured movement, you want to have that muscle engaged. So they encourage it. And our population's also very exercise intolerant. So because of the changes, so they encourage starting small. They encourage having a physiotherapist who is well-versed in hypermobility so that they're not doing damage, because lots of the treatment focused for this group is trying to stop damage from happening. It's a preventative approach. And I was listening to a webinar out of the UK from a physiotherapist, and she was saying that within 48 hours, our muscles start to degrade. So the muscle quality starts to degrade, and then that affects the joints, that affects the ligaments, that affects the collagen, like all the tissue, the bone mass starts to degrade. So having consistent exercise, it doesn't have to be huge, doesn't have to be an hour a day, but even if you're bedridden, so sometimes with hypermobility, you can't leave bed. And she suggests flexing muscles, releasing them. You just want to get them activated. It doesn't have to be bodybuilding at the gym, but definitely movement is part of it. Movement therapy, doing yoga, not within excessive range, but that it's just really good to get the body moving, feeling like, especially the low back. So you want to get that movement in there. I find that's an area that I get super stiff in.
So just incorporating movement, again, it sounds like it's maybe no different, really. Like it has to be enjoyable for the person. If the person's able to move and likes to work out more formally, that's great. If they're able to do, like you said, some people are bedridden because they're in so much pain, that's going to look a little bit different. And dealing with somebody that's well-versed in exercise will help you along the way. You alluded to physiotherapy, Jennifer. You're going to be changing the game, and you're going to be telling all of the RMTs now all over the world about the importance of exercise in this population. So I'm looking forward to you sharing your information with all the RMTs and getting RMTs along with all of the other great RMTs that have been on the podcast so far in the past three seasons, really talking about that active care component that we often learn in school, and then you know, some of us carry on and some of us, it kind of falls by the wayside a little bit. But when you look across bodies of evidence, having an active care program in place is really, really valuable. And an active care program, as you alluded to, is different for everybody. And one of the terms that I've learned recently that I'm pushing forward, and I've learned it from dog training because I have a little puppy at home right now that, you know, drives me crazy most of the time. But in dog training, they talk a lot about thin slicing. So that's what they call it, is thin slicing to build, you know, whatever it is, a thicker sandwich. And over time, each individual slice gets that little bit thicker. Over time, that compounding effect gets you to elicit a behavior. And maybe that behavior is sit. And then you sit with distractions. And then you sit in a foreign environment. But it's done very, very slowly, very, very incrementally. And you alluded to as well, many of the people that have EDS or hypermobility and have some of these comorbid conditions are exercise intolerant. In the population that I work with in mild traumatic brain injury, a lot of individuals post-concussion are also exercise intolerant. And it's the same principles of thin slicing, sub-symptom threshold. Maybe you're only able to do 10 minutes at a certain heart rate. We get you there and people can't see me, but you want to be doing this where your symptom burden is generally speaking below the activity that you're doing. And over time, the activity gets maybe a little bit more intense if that's what you're looking for. And I really, really like this concept. I think a lot of it's being taken from like graded exposure concepts of from psychology. And now we're applying them into the environment of movement. And they've been around for a long time and they're starting to make more and more inroads into our profession now. But I just heard that thin slicing analogy this year and I really, really enjoyed it. So I'm going to be using it in some of my courses as well.
Yeah, that's great.
What about things to avoid in either, well, we kind of talked a little bit about treatment. I guess it just goes back to individualized care, right? Everybody's a little bit different. There's not going to be one thing at large that we can say that individuals should avoid. And I think, and maybe speak to this as well from your perspective, but that idea of just you can't do this anymore, people don't like to hear that, right? If you, like you alluded to with yoga, if people love doing yoga and they can do it in a modified fashion, and that's what really helps them, then why shouldn't they be doing it? I had a gentleman come in his 80s, and he was a very, very active individual. He did walking every day. He really enjoyed his racket sports, weight training. And he came in, I can't remember what was bothering him. And I think he was 88 or 89. And he had been to another healthcare provider that said, stop doing all this and be sore. And I asked him, well, how is that going? Like, how is stopping you helping? And he said, it's not helping and I'm miserable.
Yeah.
And I said, okay. And I said, well, what would you like to do? And he said, I would like to, and just listed off all those things. I would like to do this, and do this. He asked me, what do you think about this? And I said, go and do it. And he said, well, is it going to make me worse? And I said, you know, it might aggravate. He had no formal diagnosis. He had like, it was a sore whatever, whether it be sore shoulder, sore knee, what have you. And I said, well, you know, there isn't anything really sinister in any of the imaging that you've got, so it might make it a little bit more sore. But if you're able to work around it or modify it, or if you're able to manage the pain with something else, then, you know, this is something that you've worked. This is something that's gotten you to the age of 88. You've been very active. He was just so happy to be able to move again in a way that he wanted to move. And I just, after that conversation, I just thought we really sometimes underestimate the detrimental effects of pulling the reins so tight on people. I know that in my field of concussion, it is one of those things where, again, you've really got to walk the fine line of active care programs, but not allowing maybe too much. But it really comes back to that person-centered care, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. So with us, like, we're planning a backpacking trip in the mountains this summer. So we're doing, it's called the Juan de Fuca, and it's 50 kilometers. So we're just breaking it down into parts. We're doing it over 5 days instead of three or whatever normal people do. Some people run it in a day. Yeah. So we're just breaking it down. It's me and my sisters and my daughter going, and all of us experience like dizziness and nausea. And if we push too hard, it's going to be a disaster. But it's just knowing ourselves and like, how far can we push and how much can we distribute the load? Because we're packing everything on our backs for 5 days. So I am nervous and excited, and all the emotions come out. We were going to do it last year, but then with the COVID restrictions and then the forest fires, and it just didn't work out. So we're not going to stop doing the things we enjoy if it's not detrimental. So we're excited to pursue that.
Yeah, it's just, it's about finding that fine balance as well. Mm-hmm. I had this question come in from somebody that knew you and I were going to be speaking, and speaking of kind of movement and such, she asked me, and I don't know whether you have much of an opinion on this, or just sports that encourage excessive range of motion. Things like, well, gymnastics is the one that comes to mind for me most. I don't know whether figure skating is maybe as prominent, but I know gymnastics does obviously like the sustained end range stretching. I don't know how prominent it is still, but I know it used to be. If you're already dealing with a potential EDS person with hypermobility, then that could potentially raise a lot of concerns, couldn't it?
Yeah, ballet is another one. There's a podcast called Bendy Bodies. I was listening to an interview last night where they interviewed some of the physiotherapists and I think choreographer, but they interviewed them and like, what are you doing with your hypermobility population? Because EDS and hypermobility is like that flexibility so valued in those performing arts. So they're trying to bring that awareness to the group, because she was saying that the dancers, they'll just do it. Like they love that doing it so much that they'll push themselves. And she said, we want the dancers to be able to give 100% on the performance day, not 100%. And then leading up to the performance day, they're done. Like they can't even do it. So they're definitely working within the scope and the field and trying to help the dancers be able to perform and carry out their job as well.
That's really interesting. What about in some of the other pursuits of finding all this information? Are there, I know you had alluded to one prominent researcher earlier in the podcast. I think her name was Anne, I think you said.
Yeah, Anne Maitland.
Anne Maitland. Are there any other researchers that you're really following right now that interest you?
Dr. Claire Francomano. So she's a geneticist, and she's the one who led the ECHO program that I was taking. And you can listen to her. She's on the Hypermobility Happy Hour. They interview her on there. And when they read her credentials out, it's like 45 minutes into the podcast. She's just a brilliant. And she's been doing hypermobility and HEDS or EDS for years, like decades. So she's someone to watch out for too. I just love listening to her speak. She's so brilliant on the topic.
And what was the name of that podcast? Bendy Bodies?
One is Bendy Bodies and the other one is the Hypermobility Happy Hour.
Tell us about your, because I know you're in the process of coming up with a course.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe as we sum up the topic, leave us with any other general points of information you feel like we need to know about EDS. This has been really, really valuable so far. But then talk a little bit about the course that you're working on with Eric.
Yeah, so I'm kind of in the middle of creating a course. It's going to be on hypermobility and hypermobility Ehlers-Danlos syndrome and really like a massage therapist perspective. So it's going to be summing up all this stuff. There's way more information that will be available through that. When I was going through and trying to break down talking points today, I was just like, this is too much information. we can't possibly cover this in a podcast. So yeah, there'll be more information. We're going to go through how to assess and things to watch for. And we won't be doing like specifically treatment during the course, but we're going to be looking at, I really want to emphasize research and how to find good research and actually go through this research with the class.
When are you two thinking about launching, like later this year?
Yeah, so I actually just booked a room. So tentatively, my course hopefully will be ready to go for June 11th and 12th weekend.
And where is that going to be, in BC?
Oh yeah, sorry, in Chilliwack, BC. Yeah, I just booked one in my town for now. And then hopefully it's very valuable.
Oh, I'm sure it will be. I think that I know I've definitely had some takeaways with respect to just how to better structure, particularly my intake and how I organize some of my physical exam stuff with respect to this population. So I'm assuming that a lot of people that have listened to today's episode that are either therapists or the general population will definitely get value out of it. If they want to learn more about the course or just even some of the great resources you're posting online, Jennifer, where can they find you on social media?
Yeah, so I'm on Instagram, Jennifer Stacy RMT. I'm not on Facebook at all, but Instagram is probably the number one way to get a hold of me. If you Google me, my business comes up and that has a link to my website. Not much for information on there, but you can find me that way. My email's on there. If you wanted to reach out, my email is jenniferstacyrmt@gmail.com. And yeah, that's it.
That's great. And your practice is in Chilliwack, right?
Yes.
Well, thanks so much, Jennifer. This was a great chat, and I'm sure a lot of people will find it really, really valuable. I hope everyone also enjoyed this episode and it was valuable to you. Have yourselves a great weekend, and we'll see you in the next one.